article in which they tried to sum up 1975. They placed as the caption of the article this phrase: "It was a dumb year, really." And some of you may recall seeing in our morning newspaper a cartoon just a few days ago, which was divided into 12 distinct blocks. In each of them, there was an outstretched arm, thumbs down, and a caption which gave the name of the month, each of the 12 months, and then a mildly despondent expletive: January, yuck; February, fooey; and so on. And at first blush, when I thought back over the last 12 months, I was reminded of some images from the 59th chapter of the book of Isaiah. This chapter is not one of the prophecies of the original Isaiah, but of a man who lived in the late 6th century before our era, who was one of a small band of noble-minded Judeans who had come back from the Babylonian exile because they had been encouraged to do so by a series of messianic prophecies by Deutero-Isaiah, come back full of high hopes that they'd be able to rebuild the capital, Jerusalem, refurbish and rebuild the temple. There were not very many of them, and they lacked the money and the wherewithal, and they lacked plans and leaders. And each day they failed to achieve what they hoped to achieve. They became more and more despairing and despondent. Gloom settled in and frustration. And then this anonymous prophecy was brought. Or rather, this is a series of images from one of the prophecies. Megashasha ki ivrim kir. We grope away our way along a wall as if we were blind men. We feel our way along as if we were sightless. Kashalnu batzaharayim kanesher. We stumble at high noon as if it were pitch black. The sense of stumbling along, of a society, of a world which was somehow faltering, indecisive in its movements, was very much the feeling that many had of the year. And when one stumbles along, that's not a very dignified way of process. There's a sense that of shuffling, of indecision, almost of purposelessness. And since the President of the United States, by virtue of his office, is a man whose every act becomes, in a sense, symbolic, the rather innocent physical clumsiness of our president became a living symbol to many that this was a year of stumbling. He stumbled up the steps of airplanes and down the steps of airplanes. He stumbled over the feet of small boys carrying American flags. He stumbled getting into chairlifts at his favorite resort, skiing. He stumbled, as you recall, often with his tongue welcoming Anwar Sadat to Washington, New York, as the president of Israel. Now, all of this is innocent. It doesn't go to his character at all. But leadership, to be effective, must have a certain magic to it. And poll after poll of Americans indicated that we were disenchanted with leaders and leadership institutions. The very word disenchantment suggests the lack of that magic, that our leaders simply lacked the words, lacked the charisma, lacked the ability to make us feel that they knew what they were doing, that they were doing something beyond simply shuffling or stumbling along at high noon as if it were pitch black. Now, when I thought of the year, my first thoughts were of these, that it was a dumb year, it was a year in which we might turn our thumbs down, a year of stumbling along. Certainly the first months of 1977 were months of gloom and despondency, thumbs down months. Early in 1975, on the 13th of January to be exact, the president made a nationally televised address in which he said straight out, the state of the nation is bad. He was concerned primarily with the problems of the economy, of inflation, recession, of energy. And he had reason to be concerned, good reason. 500,000 Americans were being added each month to the unemployment rolls. During the last quarter of 1974, the figures that were before the president, the gross national product, which is the index of all the goods and services produced in the United States, had declined at an annually adjusted rate of something on the order of 9%, 9.2%. And the statistics of the productive output of America were dropping at an annual rate of something over 12%. There were over 7 million Americans unemployed. Detroit had almost shut down. We were being offered rebates of cash. We were willing to buy from the glut of cars that Detroit had produced. Inflation was continuing among us to eat up our ability to purchase necessary goods and services. At a double-digit rate, it was still over 10%. We had not solved the problems of energy. We had not solved the problems of the recession. We had not solved the problems of inflation. And there was every reason for our president to say that the state of the nation was bad. And added to the economic gloom was the news from Southeast Asia. Within a week after the president's nationally televised address on the economy, the North Vietnamese launched a massive tank-led attack on the south. They first moved into the central highlands and then down the coastal road, and within 90 days, Saigon had surrendered. A 15-year involvement, costly involvement, by the United States, which had cost us countless tens of billions of dollars, 40,000 lives, much of our international prestige was at an end, a catastrophic end. The president made one last attempt to throw some more good money after bad. He could not, by his agreement with the Congress, send planes or send guns or send warships or men. He asked the Congress for $565 million in late January, and he asked it in a way to try and force the Congress to give it. Can America, he said, you'll recall, abandon a staunch little ally? And the answer was, we could, and we did. And we could not only abandon South Vietnam, but we could abandon a government who was an ally of us in Cambodia. Cambodia was to fall within several months to the Khmer Rouge. And we could abandon a neutralist government in Laos. Governor Souvanaphouma was soon to fall to the Pathet Lao. During February and March and April of 1975, the United States was clearly suffering the final act in the most catastrophic international defeat and military defeat this nation has ever suffered. When one combines the bad economic news with the bad international news, one is given pause to recognize how equitably, how calmly the nation accepted the headlines and the realities of the first half of last year. In many other nations of the world, if a government was defeated abroad and frustrated at home, there would have been an uprising of one kind or another. At the very least, there would have been a search for scapegoats. There would have been a demand for the head of those who are responsible for a particular policy. There would have been a demand for radical new formulations of international and of public policy. But America remained calm. There was no scapegoating of any consequence. A rather remarkable fact. As a matter of fact, Americans accepted the defeat in Southeast Asia in the way we like best to do. We found ourselves 140,000 refugees that we could take care of. And the South Vietnamese who came to the United States became our pets and our toys. People whom we delighted to photograph and have about because they told us that we could forget all the napalm that we'd thrown and all of the violence that we'd achieved and the millions of lives that had been maimed and lost in Southeast Asia, in part because of our action, because here we were playing sugar daddy, taking care of those who were able to get out. And America did welcome the refugees and did do a remarkable job bringing them here and processing them and finding them homes throughout the nation. But let's recognize this act for what it was. We were assuaging guilt. We were putting the guilty past behind us. As I began to look more closely at this last year, I became convinced that something more ought to be said of it than thumbs down, than that it was a dumb year. By the end of the year, by December last, most of the rather modest predictions made by the administration for economic recovery had been met. From a height of 9.2% of the workforce unemployed in June of 1975, we had found ways to re-employ almost 2 million men and women. And yes, there were 8% of the workforce, 8% of the workforce was still unemployed, but all the indices made it clear that more and more would be brought into the productive sector of the economy. And 1975 was a year in which we were able to dampen the fires of inflation below the double-digit level. There's still inflation abroad in the land, but it's now running at about 7%, not at 11% or 12% or 14% as it did for a while. And those who were working in America were able at the year end to say that they had a little more purchasing power than they had at the beginning of the year. Detroit was back in business. And from a purely economic point of view, the nation was far better off than it had been 12 months before. Now, we were no longer the richest nation of the world. The great era of American abundance, superabundance, was behind us. The small little Arab sheikdoms along the Persian Gulf are now the richest part of the world. But there was plenty here. And the American economic strength had begun to reassert itself. We had our own form of oil, our wheat, our corn, our grain. We managed to have 10 straight months of a surplus in our foreign trade balance. And though I doubt that we will ever achieve the kind of superheated economy that we had a few years back, it's clear that for all normal purposes, the economy was becoming sound again. There was enough. Why then this feeling that it was a dumb year? Why this thumbs down attitude on the part of many? Well, in part because there's something more to life than the paycheck. Despite all of the hard-nosed realism of Marxist economics, once a person, once a family has enough to put food on the table and decency and over their heads and enough clothes to wear, enough for a few luxuries. The issue is no longer the number of dollars on the paycheck, but something quite other. And both our economists and many of our public servants, who bureaucrats who govern national policy, were slow to realize this. The issue in America is no longer, except for the totally disadvantaged, the other America, the poor, the 20 million, is no longer the issue simply of bread, but it's what I call the issue of the standard of amenity. Do we find increasing pleasure in the environment in which we live? And by environment, I mean not simply the home that we buy, but the community in which we live. And the answer during all of 1975 is that the standard of amenity was going down, even though the standard of the paycheck, the so-called standard of living, a misnomer, but the standard of living was going up. Our cities were shabbier places. Our cities were places where we were increasingly afraid to venture out into. This was the year of the garbage strike. This was the year of the police strike. This was the year of firemen sick call-ins. This was the year of teacher strikes. This was the year in which schools had to shut down in many places because there wasn't enough money to run all year long. This was the year in which emergency wards and outpatient clinics were cut back. This was the year in which recreation centers were not open. This was the year in which New York City almost went bankrupt. And in a sense, it was too bad that New York was the first city to become a problem approaching bankruptcy. For in many people's minds, New York is associated with an alien way of life. It's Sin City. And our president unfortunately indulged himself in a kind of mid-American paroxysm of virtue during much of the summer of 1975 in lecturing New York City and hectoring New York City about its vices. And yes, there was waste, and yes, there were all kinds of forms of economic and budgetary mismanagement involved in the problems of New York City. But what had happened in New York was clearly simply the tip of an iceberg of what was going to happen in most large industrial centers, in most great population centers in the United States. It's in the city that people live. It's in the city that services must be delivered. It's the city that educates children. It's the city that cares for the sick. It's the city that provides streets for our cars. It's the city that provides protection for our homes. It's the city that provides all of the things which go into what I call the standard of amenity. And very clearly, given inflation, given our habit of dumping into the cities the worst of the social problems of the nation and removing from ourselves from the city and with us our taxes and with us our skills and our willingness to be involved, it's clear that 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 decades of urban carelessness was coming home to roost. And Americans, all of us, we're finding the lines longer, the delays in responding to our calls for help longer, the services we had counted on less available, the dangers more apparent, the smell of the city more aromatic. And it was clear during 1975 that no one had a very real and effective answer to the question, the problems of the city, to the how we might improve the standard of amenity, our pleasure in living in the environment in which we live. There was obviously a need for a different and more effective type of leadership in our communities. But who are we to complain? We who 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 40 years ago, every single one of us, opted to live outside the city, opted to put our skills, our political interests into some other political entity. And what was true of suburban Cleveland was true of the middle class throughout the nation. Our cities were in trouble. And suburban America was discovering that it could not escape these troubles any longer, because the troubles affected the place where the husband worked and the emergency room where children came with needs for first aid and the schooling of tens of thousands of people whose adequate schooling is an obvious responsibility of the nation. There was a need for a new kind of leadership in America. a new kind of urban concern. And there was no evidence throughout the year that anyone had answers to these problems. If the President of the United States seems physically clumsy, the mayor of Cleveland was politically clumsy as well as physically clumsy. The president might fall up and down stairs. The mayor of Cleveland managed to put his hair on fire. Now, typical of this, or rather symptomatic of this concern with what I call the standard of amenity, was our concern with, our overriding concern with one of the multitude of the problems of the city, the problem which reminded all of us that we could not escape the city itself, and that's the problem of crime. Crime, particularly violent crime, rose dramatically during 1975. And it rose more in the suburbs than in the city, and more in the rural areas than in the suburbs. No one escaped crime. Crime has wheels. Crime is mobile. Now, crime was obviously related in part to the recession, to need. Crime was in part related to drugs, to the indifference of America to a problem which arose some 15 years ago. But most of all, crime was related, violent crime was related to the gun. And America was no closer at the end of 1975 to gun control than the world was close to arms control. 5 million more guns, handguns, were produced in the United States for civilian consumption during 1975 than had existed in the country before 1975. Everyone could get a gun. Almost everyone had a gun. And guns were going off and explosives were going off with unbecoming lethal regularity. America faced not only street crime, but it faced the violence of little people. The world faced that kind of violence. We called it terrorism. 1975 was supposed to be the International Women's Year. And on a basic level, women continued to make large strides towards economic parity. But somehow the women who came to the forefront during 1975 were not the 12 rather middle-level women who made the cover of Time magazine this week, but a woman called Squeaky Frome and a woman called Sarah Jane Moore. Women who had guns in their hands and were aiming those guns at the President of the United States. The multiplication of guns, the ease of access to violence, was a problem to which no one seemed to have a solution. Violence, to a degree, was random. Sometimes it had a purpose known only to the bemused pathological minds of certain ideologues. We had the violence of the Symbionese Liberation Army, so-called. We had the violence of the IRA tossing bombs into Italian restaurants in London to solve an Irish problem. We had the violence of Arab guerrillas aimed not only at Israel but at their own OPEC ministers. We had the violence of islanders from Molucca attacking the Dutch government because the Indonesian government had not granted independence to South Molucca. Wherever we turned during 1975, we faced someone planting a bomb in LaGuardia, holding the gun at the back of some friend, showing a gun off to some neighbor. And in a sense, the thumbs down feeling that some of us had was not so much related to the problems out there, but to our inability as a society to take ourselves in hand and to pass effective gun control legislation, which to me means simply the prohibition to any civilian to have any gun in his house, in his possession, for any purpose whatsoever. Until that time comes, I am convinced, whatever forms of registration we devise, they will be pointless and useless. The city of Cleveland passed a handgun control legislation act this year. 6 guns were registered. There's a great to-do now in all the suburbs of Cleveland to pass a handgun control legislation bill. What will it achieve? The guns will still be there. Until America is willing to take itself in hand and to remove guns from the social order, until that time, violence will increase and violent crime will increase, and there's really no way around it. It was a year in which Americans faced a lowering of their standards of amenity, of the standard of amenity. Our pleasure was less. Cleveland, in our suburbs, there were more problems. And the solutions to most of these problems was not clear. And so it was a time when Americans claimed that they felt more distant than before, more disenchanted than before with their leaders, because no one seemed to be offering them a quick panacea, a quick solution to the problems which we're all about. How to handle the question of amenity, how to handle the question of crime, how to handle the question, all the questions of the city. Yes, in part it was a failure of leadership. Our leaders still seem to be arguing on the issues of yesteryear. On a national level, there seemed to be no effective center of wisdom. The president and the Congress began the year arguing over energy policy, and they ended the year arguing over energy policy, and there was no energy policy throughout the year. And at the end of the year, we were more dependent than we had been before on foreign oil. At the end of the year, we were producing less domestic oil than we had at the beginning, and we were exploring or investing less money in the exploration for oil and natural gas than we had at the beginning. We began the year with the President and the Congress arguing with each other over tax reform and tax policy. We ended the year with the President and the Congress arguing with each other over tax reform and tax policy. There was no effective tax reform during 1975, and there was little effective change in our tax policy. We looked to our leadership, and we found instead of effectiveness, instead of wisdom, we found a rather shabby series of exposés about the senile, alcoholic, and sexual proclivities of some who were in Congress, and about the sexual gymnastics of some who had been our presidents. And we were saddened. But it was not simply the revelations of certain shabbiness in their lives that disturbed us. It was the sense that the institutions of the government, often manned by people of great competence, were somehow spinning wheels out there for their own purposes rather than to serve the country, the people, to serve us. This year saw, throughout the year, the long, damning investigation of our intelligence agencies. And it became clear that presidents from Franklin Roosevelt on, with the possible exception of President Truman, had used the intelligence agencies of the United States for personal and factional benefit, as well as for the purposes for which they were created. And Americans were concerned not simply with the revelations that much of our mail had been opened, our international calls had been monitored, various political groups had been deliberately infiltrated and actions instigated. But as these revelations went on, as we went to church each week, we became more and more aware that some of these agencies were not only abusing their mandate and their power, but terribly inept and terribly incompetent. How many assassination attempts do we now know of against Fidel Castro? It was not simply that the idea of assassinating a foreign leader repelled some of us. It was that the intelligence gathered by the CIA and the other intelligence agencies was so often erroneous. They were wrong about the October War in 1973, the events that led up to it. They were wrong about the Cyprus fight between Greece and between Turkey. They were so often wrong. And this gave us pause. And what we lost during 1975 was a sense that the experts sitting in Washington on top of a mass of secret information knew far better than we knew what was good for the nation. We watched the greatest expert of them all, Henry Kissinger, turn a squabble between Greece and Turkey and over Cyprus into an issue in which the United States managed to alienate both parties. We watched the same great mastermind at work during March of the last year, shuttling between Amman and Jerusalem and Cairo and Damascus to achieve an interim agreement over disengagement in the Golan and the Sinai, and failing to achieve that agreement. We watched as events began to boil in Angola, and bitterness between the Congress and the Secretary precluded any kind of effective action over Angola, and worse than that, neither side was able to make its point of view clear to any of us. No one, as far as I know, understands why we should be involved in Angola or why we shouldn't be involved in Angola. All that we know is that there's a kind of loggerhead meeting between Congress and the Secretary on the issue, and that seems to be the issue, rather than the national well-being, the national interest. It was not a good year for experts. It was not a good year for bureaucratic institutions. It was not a good year to be a leader, because we were disenchanted with our leaders and we were disenchanted with our institutions. And when, in point of fact, the economy got better, most of us said it improved despite the government, not because of the government. Despite what they did, not because of what they did. I suppose there are many who end the year hoping that 1976, being an election year, will be a year which will produce new leaders, more effective leaders. I'm not one who believes in the leadership theory. Leaders can become führers. It's very easy for a nation to cry out for leadership and to mean, in effect, somebody tell me what I should do, just be certain about it. Clearly, what's demanded of all of us as 1976 begins is what the year hopefully will provide. It's a bicentennial year. It's a year not for Mickey Mouse parades, and not for the endless emblazoning of red, white, and blue banners here and there and everywhere, but a year which ought to provide Americans, all of us, with an opportunity for sober and serious reflections about our national priorities. For that's the real issue. We're a country of great economic capacity. We make and we spend a great deal of money. The question is, how do we spend it and for what? How do we provide amenity? How do we solve the problems of our cities? How do we reach down and provide welfare with decency to the other America, How do we provide for the national defense in a world in which detente is increasingly in question? Every sector of the economy has the capacity to make a case as 1976 opens for more money. We need more money for the poor, we need more money for the schools, we need more money for our cities, we need more money for the environment and the protection of our natural environment, we need more money for our foreign policy, that is, for our national defense. Now clearly there is not endless amounts of money out there. And clearly we have come off a decade or two where we have been terribly wasteful in all sectors of the economy. The president sees the waste in the welfare sector. And there has been in the last 15 years a great, great shift in the budget of the United States in favor of income subvention, in favor of public welfare measures. Some 31% of the national budget is spent for items which might fall under that category, compared to about 8% 20 years ago. It's a great increase. The president sees the waste. Many of us feel that this whole area grew and needs a good and thorough review. We need to remove a number of the layers of bureaucracy, the overlap which exists. But the president would cut back those services, and many of us believe that those services have in fact to be increased, hopefully through increased efficiency. The president wants an increase in the budget of the military. There are those in the United States who have turned isolationist because of the events in Southeast Asia, who feel that we can provide for our community, for our communal needs, only by cutting back the military budget. And I'm sure that there are areas in which it can be cut back. But clearly here, too, the issue is one of efficiency, to remove the waste. Where do those tens of millions of dollars come from that Lockheed and the other defense contractors have spent abroad for international bribes? They come from our defense budget. And where do those costly overrides come from by which some of these companies have enriched themselves? Contract overrides, they come from our defense budget. If Americans, wherever they are, whatever be their sphere of competency, will put their minds to the old Puritan virtue of thrift, of the most service for each dollar, the most effective use of each dollar we have to spend, I am convinced that without too much of an increase in our national budget, which means in our taxes, much more can be done in all areas of the economy. We need a new dedication to service. And we need a new understanding of our priorities. We seem to be falling apart into a group of people who say, on the one hand, the defense be damned, everything for the cities. And on the other hand, a group which says, the cities be damned, everything for our national defense. It's not a question of either or. It's everything, with everything else in life, it's a question of both and. But both efficiently, both effectively, both critically reviewed, so that we're doing what needs to be done and achieving what can be achieved. 1976 will be an election year. Already there are a long list of candidates in both parties vying for office. I hope and pray that as the election develops this year, someone, somewhere, will have the courage to move away from the plastic public relations merchants who have put together most of our candidates over the last 15 years, and have taught them to say what they think people want them to say, the old things, the parochial appeals, and have the courage to stand up and to talk about what he or she thinks ought to be talked about, to deal with the new problems, to offer us his or her points of view as clearly and as effectively as he or she can. I do know this, that whether I agree or disagree with a particular proposal made by such a candidate would have a good chance, will have a good chance in November of getting my vote. One of the judgments that I will make of all candidates during 1976 is whether or not they are able to walk out on their own, to be themselves, citizens, concerned, human, and hopefully wise. Because we've had now, for too long, carefully orchestrated elections which produce for us put together, made up candidates who seek office rather than bespeak a philosophy, a point of view. And we all of us need during this bicentennial year, during this new year, to find a new commitment to citizenship, to find our philosophic and our public roots. I said when I began that many turned thumbs down on 1976, 75. I do not. I rather look at 1975 as the year after the storm. I'm reminded of a pool shook by the storm, all the mud at the back of the bottom of the pool, you know, having blackened and grayed the waters. It takes a while for the pool to settle down before you can see to the bottom, see the fish and all that lives in the pond. Three great shocks went through the American body politic in these last 18 months. The shock of Watergate, crisis of leadership, the shock of Vietnam, the crisis of military and political defeat, the shock of the recession, the recognition that the age of superheated prosperity was behind us. I'm rather impressed with the way in which America has come through these three tremendous upheavals. I am convinced that as the pool, the pond quiets down, as we catch our breath, and I think we did catch our breath this year, we'll begin again and have the courage again to begin the long climb out of some of our problems towards a better society. At least I hope so.